A reading from the book of Exodus, chapter 4, verses 1 through 17. Moses answered, "What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, 'The Lord did not appear to you?'" Then the Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" "A staff," he replied. The Lord said, "Throw it on the ground." Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, "Reach out your hand and take it by the tail." So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. "This," said the Lord, "is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." Then the Lord said, "Put your hand inside your cloak." So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous. It had become white as snow. "Now put it back into your cloak," he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, "If they do not believe you or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground." Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say." But Moses says, "Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else." Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, "What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." The word of the Lord.
It wasn't too long ago, I heard an interview with Robert De Niro, and he was asked, great question, which was, what would you like to hear God say to you when you arrive at the pearly gates? And De Niro said, well, if God exists, he has a lot of explaining to do. And Robert De Niro, Mr. De Niro, of course, is the actor's actor, but he's also the New Yorker's New Yorker. And it has been my experience that that sentiment about who God is and how God interacts with the world is quite common. It's quite common for New Yorkers to look around and see, and to look around the world and to see the brokenness and the pain and the suffering and the corruption. And not only to question the existence of God, but if God does exist, to question his character. And therefore at Redeemer, we try to answer the kinds of questions that we, all of us, as modern people, as New Yorkers have when it comes to who God is, comes to the things of the Bible. This series, we are welcoming God to turn the tables, if you will, on us and to answer or to ask questions to you and I. Just last week, we looked at the question, a question around identity, and that was the question, what is your name? And so today, sort of on the back end of that same question, we're going to deal with the question of what is in your hand? And so we're not talking so much about identity as we are about calling, about purpose, about vocation. See, when the God of the Bible calls you into a relationship with himself, he changes the way that we actually live our lives. When you come into a relationship with God, you see God for who he is, and you never see him the same way again. And you never see yourself the same way again, and you never look at the world the same way again. And so when you enter into a relationship with him, he sends you on an altered path. It's a unique trajectory, you might say. It brings a whole new meaning to your life. God, though he wants to bring you inner peace, he also wants to put you to work. Why? To bring that inner peace, to bring his peace to the people around you. So let's look at this question. Let's ask ourselves this question. What is in your hand? And let's discover a few things. Let's look at the calling of God. Let's look at the crisis of man. And let's look at the compassion of the Lord. The calling of God, the crisis of man, and the compassion of the Lord. First, the calling of God. What does it mean to be called by God? What does that mean? Well, I think we can look at that on two different levels. The first level we're going to look at is relational. God calls you, it's a relation, right? It's a relationship. The second level is a vocation. He calls you into a relationship with him, and then he calls you to do some to do work. He calls you into a relationship with himself, which, as I mentioned before, is life-changing. It's life-reorienting. You see him, and you never look at things the same way again, all right? So it's a relationship. It's a life-changing, and it's a life-saving relationship. The second thing that he calls you into is a vocation. He calls you to a purpose, to an arena. He gives you a calling on your life. And this is very important. He calls you to these two levels, relational and vocational, and they're never reversed. There's an order. See, God is not looking around the world for altruistic people, because there aren't any. He's not looking around the world for the competent people, because the standard of God is so high, he will be looking forever. The Bible says that God chooses the weak things of the world to shame the strong. What does it say? 1 Corinthians 1, God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame the wise and the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God is looking for a few good men, if you will, but he's going to make them. So you never reverse the order. He calls you into a relationship with himself, and based on what you've learned, based on what you've experienced, based on the grace and the sacrificial love that he's given to you, then he sends you out in a life that permeates that and extends that to other people. So you look at and you think right before this passage, maybe it's helpful to say that Moses experienced the relational aspect through the burning bush. And that's a radical encounter in which God initiates. And so if you're new to the faith, you know, maybe for anybody, it's a good question to ask. Is it always a radical encounter like this? And the answer is yes and no. You know, when God breaks into the world, when he enters into people's lives just at face value, it's radical, right? But he does it in many different ways. Some don't feel radical at all. You know, God, people come to faith in the God of the Bible. They come to faith in Jesus sometimes at an age that is so young they don't even remember it. He enters into their lives, and because they're young, he enters in gently. And in a way, their relationship with God is innate. It's like learning a language. You learn it very young, and it just feels like it's a part of you. You feel a desire to want to be around God, to experience God in community, to go to church. You desire to please him. Where did that come from? It's just part of me, because God came in so young. Others of us, God entered into a relationship with us at an older age. It's one we can remember. It's mysterious, and yet you can articulate it very clearly, right? It's for those types, it's kind of like falling in love. Look, it's very relational, right? It's kind of like falling in love. We've all met people that they met their spouse. They saw their spouse for the first time. They walked into the restaurant and they said, "That's the man I'm going to marry someday." Or, "That's the woman that I want to be my wife." And then others of us, maybe you've just been around a person for a while. Maybe you've seen them from afar, and now maybe you're sitting across the table from them, and they make a gesture, they have a comment, and your ears prick up and your eyes tune into something, and you're attracted to them, you're drawn to them, you understand them differently. And then you get to know them, And by getting to know them, you not only get to know them, but you see the whole world in your life differently through them. Now, if you amplify that experience times about a trillion, you have what Moses experienced in the burning bush with God. He first receives a relationship with God. And then he's given a vocation, he's given a purpose. And we see that in the question, what is in your hand? The first thing that we can take away from that, well, there's two qualities. The first is immediate, and the second is significant. What is in your hand is saying, what are you doing right now? What are you doing? What's going on in your life? What's going on in the life of Moses at this time? Moses at this time is a shepherd in Midian. That's like being a shepherd in nowhere. It's in the middle of nowhere. But who is Moses? Go back to Sunday school, right? Moses was born an Israelite, but through a series of events, he was raised in the house of Pharaoh, who oversaw Egypt. And he was an educated man, right? He had a life of promise. And one day, though, he looked out and he saw that an Egyptian guard was abusing two Jewish slaves. And Moses struck the Egyptian and he killed him. And out of fear, he fled. He fled the house of Pharaoh. He ran into the wilderness. He ran to Midian in the middle of nowhere. And there he built a life, if you will. He became a shepherd. And there he was, being a shepherd, when God called him and said, what is in your hand? What are you doing right now? This is what's important. He was not on a career track, right? His life did not turn out the way that he thought it was going to be. He felt unworthy. He was unworthy. And yet God, a holy God, comes to an unholy person and says, I want to be in a relationship with you, and I have something for you to do. Now, I don't know if you all sense this, but you know, the Redeemer Downtown congregation is by far the youngest of the congregations. I think it's a lot because of, you know, NYU here. And so what we have is a lot of people in transition. We have people entering into college. We have people who are in college. We have people exiting college. We have people getting their job for the first time, right? Waiting for their job, waiting for their life to begin. You know, now is maybe the hardest time in history, not to be hyperbolic, at choosing a profession. Less and less careers are passed down from father to son or from, you know, family to family. With technology, of course, the world is changing. Not only are there new jobs, there's whole new industries. More and more, we are looking for work where we can be fulfilled emotionally and the expectation that you're going to cash in on these jobs is prevalent. And that creates a kind of malaise. You become blinded by the options. And Christians suffer from this as well. And we have an added ingredient to this. What does God want me to do? What does God want me to do in the grand narrative of things? He's created me uniquely. I have gifts and talents. I want to make something of my life. I want to give it to him. What can he do? And the danger of that is that we can lead us into over-introspection, stagnation, paralysis, and the gifts that God has given us, the talents God has given us, end up becoming stifled. We don't bless anybody by it. We become burdened by it, and we become a burden to other people. Do you remember the mirror of Erised? Let's see how young this congregation actually is. Pretty young. The mirror of Erised. What does that mean? It's the mirror of desire, right? Erised, shown in a mirror, says desire, and it's the mirror from Harry Potter. And what happened? Harry loved to look in that mirror. Why? Because when you looked in the mirror, it didn't show you reality, it showed you what you wanted. And what did Harry want? More than anything, Harry wanted to be with his parents. He wanted to be a part of a family. So when he looked into that mirror, he saw his parents. They interacted with him. They came to life in this mirror. What did Ron want? Rodden wanted to stand out. He didn't want to be just another Weasley, so he was the captain of the Quidditch team. But Dumbledore, what did Dumbledore say? He took that mirror away from them. Why? Because he said, people have wasted their lives exploring the possibilities, exploring the potentialities of their life, and they've wasted away. God is saying to Moses, what is in your hand? I have something for you to do right now. Are you an actor and you came to New York and you've not made it yet, but you're working in a restaurant? God has something for you to do right there. Are you somebody who moved here with your spouse and your spouse has a job and you're working at Trader Joe's? Nothing wrong with working at Trader Joe's, great place. But were you working at Trader Joe's until you establish your career? What if you have the job of your dreams? All your faculties are being put to use. You love it. God is saying, I have a vocation for you within your vocation. I have something for you to do right now. Right? What is in your hand? It's immediate. It's also quite significant. You know, I've lived in New York City for almost 20 years. I don't think I've ever met anybody who didn't come to New York to do something significant and be somebody significant. Maybe there's a few, but I don't think I've met you yet. And I include myself in that category. But when you become a Christian, your understanding of significance does change. And it becomes more and more like the qualities that we see here in this passage. What does Moses have in his hand? He has a staff. The staff is a means to an end. The staff is something that God is going to take that is very ordinary. He's going to turn it into something. He's going to make something extraordinary out of it. What's Moses called to do? Moses, before this chapter, Moses is called to go to the elders of Israel. And by going to the elders of Israel, he's going to tell them that God has heard their groans. He's seen them in bondage. And he's going to deliver them, both physically and spiritually. He's going to liberate them. And the way that Moses is going to prove to the elders that he is with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is through these signs. So what happens? The staff gets thrown on the ground, and it becomes a snake. And because all of us are afraid of snakes, including Moses, he runs. Right? But what does God say? He says, pick up that snake by the tail. So he picks up that snake by the tail. And why does that wacky story have any significance? Because the symbol of power and authority in Egypt was a snake. Go back to the encyclopedias that we read as a kid. If you've ever been to Egypt, remember the sarcophagus, right? And of Ramses II, Tutankhamun, what's on the headdress? A snake. Or two snakes. It's the symbol of power and authority. And by saying, by having Moses pick up that snake by the tail, God is telling the world, he's telling the elders, that he is the authority over that authority. And because that regime, Pharaoh's regime, was a regime built on injustice, it was built on slavery, God is saying, I am the justice over that injustice. I'm a God of mercy, and I'm a God who's come to liberate, but not just over earthly difficulties, earthly obstacles. I'm the God who liberates over spiritual obstacles. I'm the God who liberates over life and death. And that's the meaning of the hand, right? You put the hand inside and outside the cloak, and it decays, and you put it in, and it becomes healthy. God is saying, I am the God over life and death itself. Now, in a sense, there's three signs there, right? But the third sign isn't so much a sign as it is a prophetic truth. That when God's created order works against him, when God's created order rejects him, the natural course of events is death. Little by little, over time, death and decay will occur. The Nile, was the source of life in that region, right? It was it made Pharaoh's kingdom great. It was a source of transportation, industry, agriculture, building. And it's a prophecy. He's saying, watch, Pharaoh will not turn to me. And because of that, all of it will come to ruin. The river of life will turn to death. So out of that staff, we see God is calling him to something incredibly significant, powerfully significant. If that is true, what besides an iPhone is in your hand, right? What is in your hand? What's in your life? What vocation? What relationship? What's going on in your life? What is God calling you to? See, Moses is called into something significant. And because it's significant, it's also incredibly, put yourself in his shoes, it's also incredibly unsettling. Incredibly unsettling. And it's unsettling also because there's another power at work in Moses' life. And that brings us to the second point, the crisis of man. The crisis of Moses is also ours. You know, Christopher Hitchens, who is the late great atheist apologist, brilliant writer, passionate person in pursuit of the truth. When he actually said, if you could prove to me that God exists, no matter how many grievances I have against him, no matter how upset I am, if you can prove to me that he exists and it's undeniable, I'll follow him. I'll follow him because he's God. And yet, that is not what we see in the Bible, and it's not what we see with Moses. It's more difficult than that. There's a crisis. And the crisis for Moses is though he's had this incredible experience with God, he's had a significant calling on his life. Not only that's going to impact him, but it's going to impact all of Israel. We see that Moses, with every utterance, with every detail of the call, Moses shrinks from the opportunity. Why? Because he's experiencing a power and an authority in his life that is rivaling the power and the authority of God, and that is his approval, his need of the approval of other people. The crisis of Moses and the crisis for each of us is that though we may be in awe of God, we may be driven by other powers in this life. We may be driven by the opinions of others. Now, by God's design, we're called into a community. By God's design, we're meant to need other people. We're called to be in relationships with people that are deep and interdependent, that are that produce meaning and bonding, right? But the essence of what we call the fear of man is when we begin to need others for self-serving or self-soothing ways rather than loving them out of self-sacrificial ways, out of sacrificial ways. What does it mean to be, what does the fear of man mean? That's a phrase that is juxtaposed with this biblical idea, biblical truth called the fear of God. What does it mean to fear God? Well, it means to be in awe of God, to be in awe of his holiness and his power and his authority, that he stands distinct from us, that he's holy, we're unholy, and we're in awe of him. But the fear of man is when when the approval of other people, when the assurance and the affirmation and the attention that only God deserves is taken place by people, that they have a power and authority over us by their approval, by the attention that they give us, that we seek their approval and their affirmation more than we seek the approval and the affirmation of God. And this is super clear here, right, in the passage, from top to bottom. Moses is concerned about what other people think, people he doesn't even know. He's very concerned about what other people think. Why? Because he doesn't trust who he is, and he doesn't trust what he's done. He doesn't trust who he is. I am not an eloquent man. I never have been. Not even now, he says. He doesn't trust what he's done. He has a checkered past. He's killed somebody. right? He doesn't trust who he is. He knows that if he goes before these people, he's going to have no credibility in his mind. He doesn't trust who he is. He doesn't trust what he's done because he doesn't trust God. What he's experiencing is what modern psychologists call the imposter syndrome. And that's when you walk through life knowing and sensing that at any day now you're going to be revealed. That somebody's going to say he is not as smart as his resume. That the things that he's accomplished, they are not as great as I thought. He's a fraud. That's what Moses is experiencing. The imposter syndrome. And of course, the remedy for the imposter syndrome is what they say is you need to write down all the great things that you do to remind yourself that you're not an imposter. And of course, two problems with that. There are things that have happened to us in our lives in which all the little good things can never pacify, can never take away, that we'll always be burdened with. And just by feeding ourselves, reminding ourselves of the good things is really feeding the beast, isn't it? It just produces an anxiety in us that we need to do more and more and more and more and more to satisfy the crowd, which you can never satisfy the crowd. So he doesn't trust himself. He's ashamed of who he has become. And because he doesn't trust, because of those things, and because he doesn't trust God, he's not able to see to let go. Look, 2,000 years of history gives us 2020 vision, right? This is what he's not able to see. He's not able to see that eventually he and Aaron are going to speak to the elders. And the elders are actually going to believe them, and then they're going to bow down and worship God. He's not able to see that this is going to lead an entire people into freedom, out of slavery. Of course, he's not able to know and see what we can see, which is that 3/5 of the world's religions look to Moses, this man who was supposedly not eloquent, and they look to his writings and they say, this is the voice of God. He's not able to see that the one he stands before is the only one where he can be truly vulnerable, that he can entrust his life with. So, what does he do? He rejects God. He says, don't give this to me. It may be a privilege, but it's going to be a greater burden than it is a privilege. Give it to somebody else. Impose this on somebody else. Right? And when he does that, when he rejects his maker, what does God do? When he rejects his maker, he experiences the great compassion of the Lord. Because of his rejection, what does Moses deserve? Moses deserves to not only see God's anger, but to experience God's anger. But what God displays his anger, but what does he demonstrate? He demonstrates a profound mercy. A profound mercy. Look, remember what we said. Remember the third sign, the prophecy, right? When the creation rejects its creator, death and decay come. That's a sign of judgment. And what does Moses do? He says, please send somebody else. And we see the anger of God rise. It says he burned against Moses. But with the very next breath, what does God say? He's on his way. I'm sending somebody else. And he's going to be glad to see you. That's astounding. That's astounding. The anger of the Lord comes up. He should be incinerated, right? But he's not. In fact, God says, what you've asked for, I'm giving you. He's on his way. He's going to be glad to see you. And who's he talking about? He's talking about his brother Aaron. And what's Aaron going to do? It's fascinating. Not one aspect of this call is changed. He's going to have to do everything he said, but what is he giving him? He's giving him a brother to do it with him. Moses and Aaron are going to together do everything that Moses was called to do alone. Aaron's going to walk with him. He's going to speak for him. He's going to encourage him. They're going to answer the call together. right? It's beautiful. That's a picture of the Christian life. That's a call of the Christian experience. But how do you get there? You see the gospel in that picture. Hundreds of years later, this is the gospel. Hundreds of years later, God would send somebody else. What happened to that anger? Where did it go? God is a just God, and when justice needs to come down, he doesn't stifle it. He doesn't just say, oh, don't worry about it, I'll let this pass. That anger is going to come down, but where does it come down? Hundreds of years later, it comes down on Jesus Christ. Moses deserved that anger for rejecting God. The Bible says that we deserve that anger for rejecting God. But the beauty of the gospel is that anger is not going to come down on you or I, but it's going to come down on Jesus. Jesus Christ takes the place of Moses. He receives the anger and the punishment that Moses deserves. But what else does he? But why? So that you and I can receive the reward. So that you and I can receive the love. Do you see how safe it is to fear the Lord? Fear of man is this. It means that I cannot be honest with myself and I cannot be honest with other people. Why? Because I'm afraid that they're going to reject me. I'm afraid they're going to judge me. The fear of the Lord means this. I can be vulnerable before God because he loves me so much that he's willing to lay down his life for me. And not only that, but he's going to unite himself to me. And that is a gift. It's an undeserved gift. And when you receive a gift that you didn't deserve, you didn't even ask for, that's grace. Right? You know, there's a legend. It's an urban legend about Alexander the Great. And evidently, Alexander the Great, in his army, there was another guy, and his name happened to be Alexander. But this Alexander was not at all like Alexander the Great because this Alexander was a coward. And Alexander the Great evidently calls Alexander the Coward into his presence and he says, you better be like me or lay aside my name. And of course, Alexander the Coward cannot be like Alexander the Great. Who could? Very few. The relationship that Alexander the Great had with his people was that it was a performance-driven relationship. It was a shame-based relationship. It was a brutish conformity to an impossible standard that he imposed on people. But the picture that the Bible gives about Jesus is the picture of a very, very different king. Jesus Christ is the one who calls cowards and brutes into his presence. And he says, "You, neither of you can be like me." But so you don't have to lay, you can't be like me, so I'm going to become like you. I'm going to lay down my life and I'm going to give you my name. But not only am I going to give you my name, I'm going to give you a crown. I'm going to place it upon your head. You're going to have my name. You're going to be brought into a family of deep assurance, and that can never be taken away. And you're going to be called a son or a daughter of the Most High. The awe of the Lord changes hearts. The fear of the Lord changes hearts. The only thing that changes the heart who is ruled by the fear of the man is the knowledge and the embracing of the fear of the Lord. So, God provides Moses with the assurance that God's presence is going to be with him and with Aaron. But the Christian life is simply this. God doesn't just say, I'm going to walk with you. But what's astounding and what the Old Testament prophets could never have envisioned is that in Jesus Christ, God doesn't just walk with you, but he walks in you, helping you to discern, encouraging you, calling you to press on, calling you into a relationship with others. You know, the Christian life is not a private enterprise. We're called to be in community. We're called to be in deep relationships with one another, compelled by the work of the Spirit of Christ in us, which is producing grace and joy and hope and peace. so that when we are in our vocations, we have a vocation in our vocation, in which we are ambassadors, humble ambassadors, coming along other people who are created in God's image in order to share and be a part of putting injustice down, looking for opportunities where we can bring life where there's death. That's the vocation within the vocation. Now, perhaps you're saying, that sounds okay. And I want to have that kind of calling in my life. I'm not sure where I am in terms of my relationship with the Lord. I want this kind of relationship. I don't know that I'm a Christian. Keep coming. Just keep coming. Join a beta group. Keep coming. But if that's attractive to you, I hate to disappoint you, but you may already be a Christian. There's a really cool place in Philippians 1. In Philippians 1, Paul is trying to get the church to live like the church. And he's specifically talking about unity. But he's saying, get to work. And he says this. He says, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if you have any comfort from his love, if you have any common sharing in the Spirit, if you have any tenderness, then make my joy complete. Be like-minded. Be the church. Go to work. And what I love about that is the word any. What does any mean? It's the least possible amount. Have you experienced any tenderness, the least possible amount of tenderness or compassion or joy or fellowship, and you attribute that to Jesus? You may be a Christian. Sorry. But you're definitely ready. Begin. Go. Don't wait. Go forward. Allow God to work in your life. What is in your hand? Ask people to look into your life and say, help me. What is in my hand? It's hard to discern sometimes. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, to be sure, there are areas in our lives where we live as those who live in fear. Fear of what others might think of us. We live as those who are ashamed of who we are and what we've done. And Lord, as for those who are followers of Christ, we admit that far too often we are ashamed of the gospel. We hide. We deflect. We're motivated by an unhealthy awe of the approval of other people and a desire to have things our way and to pursue our own interests instead of walking with you. Lord, would you free us from our bondage to human approval so that we might obey you, so that we might answer the call that you have given your people in all times and all places. Would you liberate us so that we might free those people that we cripple with our desires and our fears? Would you liberate us by your Spirit so that we might be in awe of you and live the lives that you're calling us to live? In Jesus' name, amen.